This is Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 368 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com. And joining me from the depths of Victoria, Mr. David Marland. How are you?
Oh, I'm good, thanks, Bruce.
Excellent.
We've had an early autumn, which cool nights, but most days have been about 30 degrees.
Oh, hate you. We have had over 11 inches of rain in the last 19 days.
Oh, we got 11 mil in the last two.
Yeah. It has just been insane. And I looked at the weather forecast tonight for next week, and we're due for more rain.
And you guys reckon Victoria's wet?
I know. I'm over it. I can tell you riding 140 k's a day in the rain on a motorbike is not a whole lot of fun. But anyway, yeah. But how you been otherwise?
Pretty good, thanks. It's been busy the last few months. So I've done a couple of workshops.
Yeah.
And done a bit
as
of
in
cricket.
Conducted workshops, or you've been to attended workshops?
I have attended workshops with that well-known character, Glenn Lavender.
Uh-huh.
Attended his studio workshop, which was heaps of good learning.
Yep.
And what I liked there is we built up from a single light, studio light, and built up till we had four or five lights going. And the other one was the body painting one, which was brilliant.
Oh, okay, cool. I think he did a couple, didn't he? So did you get to the first one or the second one?
I got to the first one.
Yep.
And I think he's ended up running three.
Oh, okay.
And it was awesome. A stinking hot day.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it was a Wednesday in February. And then the next week, he picked the hottest day of the week again.
Right.
So I think the model was very happy to be half covered in water at times.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So, of course, the reason that David is joining us this week is because, as most people would be aware, if you are on Facebook at least, Glenn's dad passed away, I think it was a week ago today, actually. It was Friday of last week. So, you know, Glenn, obviously, we cut him some slack, let him have a week off, 2 weeks off. They had the funeral today. I sent Glenn a message earlier on to say, hey, mate, I'm thinking of you and hope the day wasn't any rougher than it had to be. And he sent back a message and said, thanks, mate, it went really well, and give everyone a shout out, you know, when you're recording. So, so Glenn, yeah, we wish him well. We wish him well. And I'm sure he'll be back next week.
Yeah, it's been pretty tough for him the last couple of months with his father's health.
Yeah, so for sure.
We just hope it all sorts itself out.
Yeah. So I suppose we should get on to some of the stories that we've been sent over the last couple of weeks, given that we've got 2 weeks' worth of stuff to get through.
Well, it sounds pretty good.
I should also mention, I don't know if you've noticed, you probably haven't because you've only just arrived home, but I have this evening refreshed the artwork for Shutters Inc. Podcast. So if you now go to ShuttersIncPodcast.com, you'll see there's a new banner up. I haven't changed all the colouring of the website yet. That will come in time. But I've also changed the Facebook banner and the Facebook profile pic. So I'm sure people will start to see that in their feeds. And if you're using any sort of podcast catching client on your iPhone or your Android phone, you will probably see the new artwork pop up there as well. So,
yeah. And what I like, actually, I'm having a look at it right now, Bruce, is the photograph of you is bright and jolly. And Glenn is sort of
covered in war paint.
Covered in war paint.
Yeah, that was from the Holi Festival in India last year. What happened was I wanted to refresh the artwork simply because I had lost in that hard drive failure that I had just around Christmas time.
Yep.
I lost the original artwork in its multi-layered form. So the only copy of the old artwork that I had was a flattened version.
Yep.
And when I made that original artwork, most of the, you know, podcasting specs said artwork no larger than 1,400 pixels square. And, of course, these days, you know, iTunes is recommending 3,000 by 3,000 pixels for your artwork. And so I didn't particularly want to scale a JPEG that was only 1,400 pixels on each side up to 3,000. So I said to Glenn...
Lots of grain.
Yeah, exactly. I said, look, you know, I'd like to redo the artwork. Send me a new profile pic because I no longer have your old profile pic. And that was what he sent me.
It matches in the culture of the podcast quite well, actually.
Oh, look, I think it's Glenn down to a T. I really do.
It's worth a look, people.
Yeah. So anyway, the first story that I saw this week or over the last couple of weeks was a story about an image which I've seen before, I'm sure everyone else has seen before. I was always fairly sure that it was a composite, and it is. And it's the image of an iceberg, and the top half of the iceberg, or the top tenth of the iceberg, if you like, is sitting out above the water, and it's quite huge. And then you're supposedly seeing the bottom part of the iceberg under the ocean, but it's actually a different iceberg that was shot in daylight and then inverted in Photoshop and blah, 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 blah. That image has now earned the creator, a guy called Ralph Clevenger, over $900,000 in royalties, which I thought, that's pretty cool.
That's pretty amazing.
He composited that image in 1998. So I don't know what version Photoshop was up to in 98, probably about version 4 or thereabouts.
I had a listen to the video and they're talking
about Photoshop 2. Photoshop 2, there you go.
But you'd think after earning that money, you'd have a bit better clothing.
Yes. Yeah, well, who knows? There's no accounting for taste. But, I thought, oh, well, you know, great story. I'm sure we'd all love to be able to, either shoot something or composite something that would earn us that kind of royalty. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, I've got a feeling he's very much at the right-hand end of the bell curve.
Oh, definitely.
And it's like there was the one that Windows had for some time. I think it was Windows 98 with the grassy hill.
That was XP.
The XP. And the guy that had done that one was he shot it out of his car in film days.
That's right.
Somewhere in California.
Yeah.
And it was discovered by Microsoft, and so it just went whoosh.
And it's funny because it was only, about 8 or 10 months ago that I saw a story pop up somewhere where someone had found the particular hill and valley that, you know, that iconic Windows XP wallpaper image was of. And when you see it photographed not from the same angle and, you know, without all the saturated colors, you go, it just looks like a random hill. You know, it just looks so ordinary. Like it doesn't jump out at you. Like I'm sure you could drive past it and not recognize that was the field and the hill and the tree that the Windows XP wallpaper was sourced from. You know, you could quite easily just drive by and not even give it a second glance. So, yeah.
It's like a lot of landscape photography. It's about the place, it's time of day, time of year, what the light's doing, how much cloud, all those things can make that happen. The interesting thing about this particular photo of Ralph Clevenger's is it's a composite. Nobody has griped and carried on like a pork chop that it's a composite, which I think is good because it's the image itself, it's the artwork that's important, and it's expressed a feeling, and obviously lots of commercial organisations have made use of it because it really hits a nerve, and in a way that's what art's about, and what photography is obviously conveying an emotion that in this case that's been very useful.
Yeah. I think the reason people don't get their knickers in a twist over it is the fact that he's upfront about the fact that it's a composite. I think what really riles people is when people try and pass off a composite image as, oh, this is a photo I took, when it's actually not. It's, you know, it's bits of a photo they took, but a whole heap of post work, you know, to get it to a final image. And I think that's what really riles people.
Yeah, and that example, what was it last year, the guy taking, well, what he alleged was a shot up through a ladder.
Oh, that's right.
Ladder up with the aircraft over above.
Yeah.
And tried to pass that off as a photo, and it was exposed as a composite.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. People got uptight that it was a composite, and he was trying to say it wasn't.
Now, you made a comment 60 seconds ago about it's the image that speaks to us. And at the end of the day, that's the important thing. And I normally follow my notes for this podcast as I've got them in chronological order, but I want to jump forward to a story that was the first thing that Adam sent us, which was why gear doesn't matter. And it's a great video. And I can't think of the guy's name off the top of my head. I watched the video yesterday and I subscribed to his channel ads. I was that impressed with the guy because he's actually capable of delivering entire sentences without going, and I love that. I love someone who can put a sentence together in a coherent. I'm trying not to. But it was really good.
He was excellent. I thought I watched it twice.
Really?
This was a really good video, and recommend everybody to look at it. It really doesn't matter if you use a cell phone. It's the best camera is the one you've got at the time. And the point he made a number of interesting points. One I thought was good was when the 35 millimeters started coming out, the Leicas and all that, you know, all the people with the 8x10s were going, ugh, you know, you'll never get a decent image out of that, you know.
Not enough resolution.
Or using phones. And the point he made was that cell phones are a great innovation. They can help people with spontaneity, both taking the photo and instantly publishing it.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't matter what you take the photo on, as it's the photo that's interesting. It's not all the other bits behind
it. Exactly.
And I actually found he made another very interesting comment, which was he said that when he made a video about a new product, he got a lot more people looking at that than when he was talking about photo technique.
Yeah.
And people are looking at the new and all that rather than, hang on a minute, it's the technique that really brings the value in trying to express what you want, rather than having to buy a new camera every year or a new bit of gear all the time. And I thought that was a very interesting observation, because I look at some of the history books and some of the images that they were making 150 years ago or 100 years ago or so, I still haven't got anywhere near them.
No.
And you know, they're just looking at a box with a hole in it and a bit of film at the back.
Yeah, and he covered that whole thing about the release of new cameras, you know, that back in the film days, you know, he talked about his Nikon, was it an F4?
Yes,
that's right. And how in that day and age, a flagship camera like that would be on the market for 5-10 years. And so when a new camera was released, it really was a big thing. But these days you've got manufacturers just cranking out new, you know, marginally improved bodies on an almost yearly basis, and then you've got people falling over themselves to upgrade when really they don't need to. And there's a lot of great points in that video, Adam, but I thought it was interesting, David, that you brought up that notion of the image is, you know, what's important, and it's the image that speaks to us. And that's why I wanted to jump forward to that story from Adam, because they were very, very much linked.
And the other bit there, he talked about learn your camera, which whatever it is,
yep,
learn it as well as you can so that you can express what you want with it. And it doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because there was a lot of criticism, particularly in the United States, is why it took Canon 5 years to release a new 5D. And maybe there's something in that.
Yeah.
And then they complained because there wasn't some form of video that is the latest, greatest thing, whereas the quality on the actual images that I'm making had gone up a lot. And it's sort of, well, I don't know about you, but I don't buy not that I buy them very often, an SLR to take video. I'm more interested in stills. So I think at the time I said, well, I'm not interested in all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, having a good tool to do the job, but then you've got to know how to use your tool.
Yeah. I loved his bit about cell phones being the new technology, because I've certainly been one of those people who have had this attitude of, no, if I want to take a photo, I'd rather take my SLR out and shoot it properly. And he quite beautifully conveyed this idea that this is just the newest branch in the technological tree, if you like, you know, that, you know, when it was 8x10s and 35 mil came out, you know, it had its naysayers, but there were advantages to 35 mil in that it was a lot more transportable, and cell phones now are doing, as you said, the same thing. They're more transportable. The connection to the internet means you can publish straight away. Yeah, it was great thoughts all around. I really enjoyed it. So thank you, Adam.
Spot on.
Yeah. The next one was Sony's digital filter. Now, I've seen this popping up left, right, and center. I think Adam sent it to me, and I'd seen it even before Adam sent it along. And this is a camera app, but it's only related to a couple of Sony's cameras. Like, it's not something you can just go and download from the Google Play Store or the iTunes Music Store and use it on every Sony camera. There's only a handful of cameras that it works for. But what is interesting about it is the ability to customize graduated filters in this app, and they're not just covering the whole frame. You can actually divide the frame up into three different regions and create exactly the kind of, you know, graduated neutral density that you want. So I obviously, this is aimed at landscape shooters who want to shoot into the sun at, you know, sunrise and sunset. So it gives you the ability to lighten the foreground, you know, where it might otherwise be dark, to then tone down, you know, along the horizon as the sun is either, you know, just coming up over the horizon or just about to dip below the horizon, and then a sort of a graduated density across the sky. So pretty funky looking app. I'm not entirely sure how it works, but there's a good story there and a video for anyone who wants to check it out. David, were you going to say something about it?
The thing about this one that I just had in the back of my mind is that doing it on a camera's screen is not a big place to be playing with.
True.
And you maybe my conservatism's there, but on very plain photographs with not much happening, you might have a better chance of using it than if there's a lot more complex things to do. But
yep,
it wouldn't need much of a move of the thumb or the finger in the wrong spot, and you could be altering it quite considerably. I must admit, that's probably me wanting to work with a bigger screen.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it might suit some people.
Yeah, it would be interesting. I can't remember if it was in the video or if there was another link that I saw, but the gradations didn't have to be horizontal. You could actually have converging lines.
Goodness.
For these different regions. So it's, interesting technology. And as a first, if this is only a first effort,
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here.
Yeah, look, well, I think we'll see more of that sort of thing starting to happen.
Yeah,
over time.
Yeah. Now, SkyPixel, who we mentioned last episode, running a competition for photography from drones / UAVs. We talked about it last episode, but during this week, I saw on Facebook that William Long, who runs the Photo Watchdog site and the associated Facebook group, which looks out for photographic competitions which have dodgy terms and conditions, absolutely caned SkyPixel for their terms and conditions. I haven't had a chance to go and read into exactly what it was about their terms and conditions that he didn't like, but he's got enough runs on the board to say if he reckons it's a bad one, then it's probably a bad one. So he reckons it's very much just a rights grab. So anyone who's thinking of going in it, at least read the T's and C's before you do, so you know what you're signing away in terms of, you know, the rights to your images, you know, or how that's concerned.
I haven't, like you, I haven't had the chance to look it up, but there was something else about that competition that it might be a bit of an unfair criticism of the competition, but what I find with a number of competitions is, you know, you're going to win a drone, but you've got to take a drone photo to win a drone. Or, you know, you've got to take this high, you want a Canon 5D Mark IV, but the standard of photo you've got to take to win it is virtually you've got to have a Canon 5D Mark IV. to me, why aren't those sort of competitions looking for the aspirational imagination with something that's not as good as, or, you know, the person who wins the drone can get greater benefit out of the photograph.
Yep.
You know, if they're standing on a ladder and take a great aerial photograph on the ladder, be more eligible than somebody that's already got the fancy drone.
Yeah, good point.
So good point. I always find that a bit weird, and it's not confined to photo competitions. It's confined to a whole lot of things. Yes, such photos would be wanted to be used by the manufacturer doing the giveaway, but well, it's not a giveaway, running the competition.
Yeah.
It's not often for the aspirational person.
Right.
So I didn't think standing on my roof taking a photograph of the rose bush over the edge would quite make it.
No, probably not. Probably not. The next one was something that I don't know how this came across my radar through the week, because it's a Lightroom tip. And as you all know, I have given up on Lightroom now. I'm completely in the Linux camp and loving Darktable. But this, in all of the years that I use Lightroom, I never came across this keyboard tip. And I thought, wow, that would have been really nice to know in the days when I was running Lightroom. So I thought I'd share it. In the spot removal tool in Lightroom, you can use the /key to force Lightroom to pick a new source location. So, you know, you've selected the tool and you've adjusted the brush size to around about the size of the bit of dirt on your photograph, and you click on the bit of dirt, and Lightroom places the little stamp there, and it draws the line out to the area where it's cloning from. And sometimes, pretty rarely, I've got to say, I thought Lightroom was generally pretty good at picking where to clone from. But every now and again, it'd pick a spot that just wasn't quite right. And rather than having to go and, you know, mouse onto the source circle and click it and drag it to a new location, you can just hit the /key and Lightroom will have another crack at finding a source area to clone, which I thought was a handy tip. Now, I don't know how many people already knew that one, but I certainly never came across it in the days when I was running Lightroom. And the other one was control, click, and drag to specify a preferred source if you don't want Lightroom to have a guess right from the outset the way it does by default. Instead of just clicking on the spot of dirt, you can hold down your control key, click on the spot of dirt, and then drag your mouse to where you would like Lightroom to source the replacement pixels from. And that way you've got, you know, manual control right from the outset rather than, hey, Lightroom, have a crack at it. No, you got it wrong. Now I'll go and fix it. So,
yeah. There's another one that if you use H while you're in the tool, which is about showing and hiding the pins. And if you hide the pins, sometimes when you do a spot, it doesn't cover the spot the way you want to.
Oh, okay.
And you need to do something on the edge of it, but it won't let you because you're going into the pinned area. And if you hit H for to hide the pin, you can get away with it.
And
in my follow-up to this note, I actually found out something else, because I don't use keyboard shortcuts with Lightroom.
Oh, really?
And found that control slash, wherever you are, like in develop or in library, bang, you get the whole list of them in front of you.
Is that right?
Yeah, and command slash will do the same if you're in Apple. So,
right.
Yeah, you know, you're in develop, you hit control slash, and it's got all the shortcuts in front of you.
Wow.
So you can teach yourself to do that. It's a bit of a different discipline, but it can speed up your processing of Lightroom. So I've been using Lightroom for a few years, and I didn't know that either. So,
man, I love keyboard shortcuts.
So do I. I just didn't realize I could do them all.
Yeah, right. I find that they are so much quicker than trying to use a mouse for things most of the time.
Yes.
Most of the time. Not all the time, but most of the time. So anyway. All right. Adam sent us a second story, which was Olympus killing off their four-thirds lenses.
Yeah. This is interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess this has to do with the sizes of, well, I don't know enough about how a lens is constructed, but I understand that you've got lenses which are designed to be used with a 35mm sensor, and then you've got lenses which are designed to be used with an APS-C sized sensor. And presumably, if you're in the Olympus camp, there are lenses which are constructed to be used with a four-thirds sensor.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Olympus has decided that it's getting rid of all of their four-thirds lenses. They're not going to make them anymore.
Well, what's interesting is that they introduced Olympus and Panasonic together introduced the I've got that wrong. Originally, it was in the early 2000s, Olympus and Kodak produced the four-thirds sensor as a standard.
No, you had it right. It was Olympus and Panasonic.
No, it was 2008 that Olympus and Panasonic introduced the micro four-thirds.
Oh.
But it uses the same four-thirds sensor but removes the mirror box.
Right, okay. And
so they're obviously using the micro four-thirds lenses, a little bit smaller in diameter, but they've got a couple of additional pins which supports the live view that a micro four-thirds needs for the to not need the mirror.
Right.
So, yeah, obviously they're thinking that the micro four-thirds is getting quite a big foothold, and that the four-thirds just isn't viable anymore. They haven't introduced a new four-thirds camera, I think, for about 10 years. Since 2010.
Right, so they're keeping micro four-thirds. It's the original four-thirds lenses that are being phased out.
Right, that's right.
Okay. So, I didn't realize that there were two things there, that there was four-thirds and micro four-thirds.
Yeah, and there's a
subtle difference. Not being an Olympus shooter.
Yeah, same here. Yeah, there's a subtle difference between the two. One's the extra couple of pins, and the micro four-thirds are just that little bit smaller.
A little bit smaller diameter, yeah.
But it's the same sensor, and what's interesting in the article further down, it shows the size of the same sensored camera, but in this case it's compressed laterally as well. So it's smaller, lighter bit. And so I guess the four-thirds no longer fitted. It was like a baby SLR, and so you might as well have a full-sized SLR with an APS-C, and then it didn't fit really. There was nothing to fit between the APS-C SLR and the micro four-thirds. There was that four-thirds gap. Just people weren't obviously
not a big enough market segment to warrant continuing.
Yeah, but I reckon if you have got a four-thirds, thinking back to our earlier article about the camera doesn't matter, I reckon it'd be a good time to get cheap lenses.
Totally.
So your North of England background.
Sorry?
North of England background, a bit like a Scotsman, you know, looking out for the bargain.
Right. Okay. All right. The next one was from Steve Peters. And again, I saw this popping up left, right and centre all through last week. Google has developed a new form of JPEG compression which achieves 35% savings in disk space requirements for a JPEG. Now, that's a fairly substantial saving in space. However, the downside is the compression time.
Yes.
They were saying in the article that it took something like 5 hours to save an image.
Yeah.
So I can't see this hitting the mainstream and certainly not being an export option out of Lightroom anytime soon. But, yeah, a 35% increase in efficiency in terms of file space, but without any degradation in the image quality. So
yeah. Watching brief on that one, I reckon.
Yeah. See where it goes. Knowing Google, they'll work away at it and they'll find a way of making the encoding faster. So. Yeah. Yeah, we'll wait and see.
Exactly.
David Kembry sent us a link to Creative Live, and this was how to piss off a photographer. Now, I'm not a Reddit user, so I'm a little in the dark as to how Reddit works, but I understand that there are subreddits which are kind of like forums on different topics, and there is a subreddit for photography. And the intro to this article says, like many photographers who enjoy keeping up with relevant and irrelevant news on photography, I often find myself frequenting the photography subreddit on reddit.com. The content varies from the odd tip or trick to the next big camera coming onto the market, but of course can also contain the thoughts and feelings of photographers around the world. That said, when a thread title starts with "piss off photographers" with one sentence, you know it's going to be a fully packed bag mixed with all the laughable but cringeworthy things that many of us have experienced. And so then there's a whole bunch of, you know, sayings that we've all heard and all cringe at. Yes, I used your photos on my site, but I added filters so they've been changed enough that they're my art.
I could take great pictures too if I had a camera like that.
Oh, so your photos are photoshopped.
Ah, but my phone's got more megapixels than your big expensive camera. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch there if you want to have a bit of a chuckle. So thank you, David. Rob Coates sent through an email just today on Aspiritas, how a Tasmanian geologist helped classify a new type of cloud. So this fella, Gary MacArthur, is obviously a geologist, and he's noticed these cloud formations in Tasmania that he thought, they look interesting. He photographed them, and, yeah, it's a new type of cloud, a new cloud formation, and they're now known as Aspiritas.
They're sort of like upside-down wavy hills.
Do you know what it reminded me of? It reminds me of acoustic foam.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I wonder if this is something that only happens in Tassie, because I've certainly never seen cloud formations like that anywhere I've ever been.
I've seen things sort of like that. I used to do a lot of flying and gliding.
Oh, okay.
And you do see things sort of like that, but not quite to the same extent.
Yeah, right.
And it just goes to show that you, you know, if anything looks interesting, take a photo. Someone may not have seen it before. It would be interesting whether they're obviously clustered as a type, so it can't be just a transitional one-off event that you might capture.
Right.
Because they've said this is the best example and is this now the standard picture. But I noticed that the article said to mark World Meteorological Day, a new edition of the International Cloud Atlas has been launched.
Right.
And it has 11 newly classified clouds in it.
Wow.
And this is one of them. So the stuff we're always...
I love that further down in the article, he said, I was just lucky. The other entrants were just as good as far as I was concerned. I think they picked mine because it had no enhancement. Some of the other photos had a bit too much enhancement and looked a bit too unreal.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Love it.
Well spoken.
Now, David, you wanted to talk a little bit about this three-way adapter thing for traveling.
Yes.
Talk us through this.
Yeah, a little later in the year, I'm going to be doing a bit of travel. And I'm faced with having an old and large portable computer. And
as in heavy, a laptop?
As in a laptop.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to lug that around New Zealand.
Okay.
And so I'm thinking of what would fit into my camera pack that would be light, because I want to make the 7 kilo load.
Oh, this is for your in-cabin luggage?
In-cabin carry-on luggage.
Yep.
And the other part about it is I've got a couple reasonably new lenses that I want to play with, and I want to put more into the camera gear to take along rather than the computing gear. So I started investigating how I could use my little Galaxy Tab to be able to store my RAW files until I could get back home and use them.
Right.
Because I tend to take an awful lot of photographs, that the tab itself can't handle the size of
not
the
enough space.
Just not enough space. Even with a little 64 gig card, I don't trust it.
Yep.
So I investigated being able to add a portable hard drive like a WD Elements or a My Passport. And you can with Android. I guess the first point is you need what's called an OTG cable, which plugs into the micro port of the Samsung or Android. And then that can then be plugged into a USB card reader. So I take my CF card out of my camera, plug that in, and I can load the photographs from the day onto the pad.
Yep.
The next trick is now taking it off the pad and putting it on a hard drive.
Right.
The problem is that your pad doesn't have the grunt to power the hard drive.
Right.
So I did a lot.
You know what you need? You need a wireless Western Digital drive.
Yeah, but I don't have a wireless Western Digital drive.
Do you not remember the saga that happened 2 years ago?
With Glenn?
No, with me.
Oh, yours?
In Borneo.
No, I don't want to go there again.
No, neither do I.
So I'm going old-fashioned power.
Right.
So the trick to these is the thing I got hold of is a Lava Soft charge adapter, OTG host charge adapter, and I've sent you the note to it. There's a Skype picture.
Yep. Yeah, I've got the link. Yep.
So it's got three lugs or holes in it. One connects to the OTG back to the pad.
Yeah.
The other side of it connects straight to the USB to, say, your hard drive. But the third outlet will connect to the micro USB port that you then connect to the power, to your 240 volts.
Right.
So you've got the power coming in one side. It's powering up your portable hard drive, but it's also permitting a data connection between the hard drive and the pad. Now, the big problem in getting the Lava charge adapter was that I couldn't get it easily in Australia, and a number of the American outlets wouldn't sell to Australia. I don't know what it is. I think we're some foreign country. But I did manage to find an outlet. Fishpond had it, and it cost a few bob, you know, about $50-odd to get out. I've since discovered that the other alternative is like a Y cord, which has got a USB with two micro SD cords coming out. One's a male and one's a female. One goes into your pad and the other one you connect to the power. But the trick is to get the power into it. So then my idea is now I transfer the photos from this CF card onto the pad, then copy that onto my portable hard drive, and I'll have two portable hard drives. My wife will carry one and I'll carry the other.
Yeah, right.
And I'm going to experiment with Lightroom Mobile to see if it can cope with a catalogue being on the
external drive.
Yeah, because nice. The behaviour of once it all gets going – the behavior of the pad with the little My Files application is it's just as if the USB connected hard drive was just part of the pad, just as the SD card is.
Yeah, right.
So interested to try that. And of course, instead of lugging around a large old laptop, and I can't afford one of those lovely Microsoft Surfaces.
Yeah.
I can do it this way, and it's probably going to cost me less than $100. Oh, and I would have bought the hard disks anyway. as backup. So I'm going to have a bit of a play with that and see if it works.
Yeah.
So, we've put the link there in the notes, which just shows the Larvasoft one being demonstrated by the Larvasoft people. But there are a couple of other ways of doing it. And I discovered through the OTG you can connect up. Another way of doing it is that you can get a USB-powered hub.
Yep.
That's a powered USB hub. And as long as it's got an input for the micro SD, you can then run a number of USB items off it.
Right.
So there's quite a lot of versatility there. Oh, but there's one trick. One really important trick is that the hard disk drive has got to be formatted in FAT32 or XFAT.
Oh, okay.
Because most of them are already pre-formatted in NTFS.
Yep.
And most of the Android devices are not of that generation.
Right.
But at least it's all backwardly compatible when you want to take it and put it back at your computer at home.
Right.
It's because it's like your USB stick. That's either an XFAT or a FAT32 formatted device. And that's the other trick. So just reformat the portable hard drive and away you go.
Yeah, right. I'm going to have to look into that. The idea of the AC-powered USB hub, I'm just a little dubious as to if you have one of those, because I've got one of those here at home that I'm going to try that out. If you connect from that hub to the OTG cable that's plugged into the Samsung tablet, is the tablet going to recognize the hub to the level of complexity where it will then see a card reader and a hard drive hanging off the other side of the hub as well? I'm going to have to try that.
Yeah, it can see the car. It can see the hard drive.
Even through a hub.
Through the hub. Yeah. Not the little thing I've got. Well, again, I've only seen that on some of the YouTube pictures. But it needs to be a powered hub. And I think it's something to experiment with, because if you've got two or three, you could have a keyboard and you could have a.
Well, the thing that interests me is the idea of being able to take a little AC-powered four-port hub, and if it's possible that the tablet can be attached to one port of the hub, the card reader can be attached to another port of the hub, and the hard drive could be attached to a third port of the hub, then you should theoretically, if what you're describing is, you know, if it's really going to work the way I think you're describing it, you should then from the tablet be able to drag copies from the card reader direct to the hard drive without having to copy to the tablet first.
Yeah, exactly. It depends whether, I think what you'd need is I wonder if the OTG, in this case, the OTG for the Larvasoft, is a micro USB to micro USB, you might need a hub that's got a micro USB input. But right. I just spotted that on the way through in investigating all of this, so it's probably worth an investigation and report back.
Well, I will definitely be trying this out, because that could be a fantastic solution for me on my trip to Europe later in the year. Because I'm in exactly the same boat as you. You know, I shoot RAW. I'm not going to have enough storage space on my Galaxy Tab S to store 4.5 weeks worth of photos. So I'm going to need to take probably a 1 terabyte external drive. And I had sort of been thinking this through, thinking, okay, I'm going to have to mount the card reader to the tablet, copy all the day's photos off to the tablet, and then unmount the card reader and then mount the external hard drive and then copy from the tablet to the hard drive, which is a lot of mucking around at the end of the day when you're exhausted, you've had a big day of sightseeing and you just want to crawl into bed. But
well, don't forget the few beers by the river.
Yes. Yes, the sangria priorities, in Spain, man. And the port in Portugal, and the red wine in France. Yes. Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, the other one I'm curious about, even with this little setup I've got, because I've got that, you know, you've got to go from card to pad and then pad to hard disk, yep. is whether one of those little power packs can do the powering. If you're a bit short of getting to a AC power, so you know, you can get those little yep. power packs that yep. charge batteries yep. And all that. You may not, because it's probably only trickle charge, but yeah, there's a lot of experimentation to have a look at when doing that.
Mm.
But the other bit though about all of this is that the recent news that travelers, particularly from some Middle Eastern countries.
Yep.
Not be able to take anything bigger than a cell phone into the cabin. And that include. I noticed it included iPads, cameras and laptop computers would also have to be put in checked luggage. And I, for one, would not be too keen on my SLR.
No.
My precious aged but very valuable to me SLR going into checked luggage.
Yeah.
I noticed it's from some countries, and I think particularly if you're going to Europe, going into then the if you go then into the UK, or you're not going to America, but if you were, if you had a stopover at a couple of places, and I think Dubai's one
right.
That's named.
We're going through Doha, which is the capital of Qatar.
Right. That may or may not be one of the name ones, but, you know, there's no point giving everyone a link because it's all over the press. But I think
yeah, right.
Yeah, you have to do a bit of homework on that. If you stay in a certain country for a while, does that mean that the next part of your journey you've got to store your equipment differently and not take it on board? And I think that's a bit scary, because we value our equipment. I guess going into the US is probably options of hiring stuff, but it's not the same.
No. I don't know what I'm going to do with my camera gear, you know, because my f-stop bag, which is a backpack, is bordering on being a little bit too large to take on board. I have got away with it on previous trips, but I know that it just seems like everybody's clamping down on what you take into the cabin these days, and I certainly wouldn't want my camera going into the hold of the aeroplane just in the f-stop bag.
No way.
Because I don't know that I can lock it to stop people getting into it.
Yeah, you virtually need a Pelican case with locks and that on it. And then, of course, to cheapen it, you've only got a certain number of kilos of check-in luggage anyway.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a no-win there. We don't know. It's got a limited time until about October, but they may renew it. They may you know, extend it.
So is this all because of America's tightening of immigration stuff, or is this related to the whole Samsung exploding Galaxy S7 debacle, or is it something else? What's driven this?
It's a bit vague yet, because it's the article's only a couple of days old, and some of our listeners may know a bit more. But I think the other part, they're restricting it to Middle Eastern countries, and it may have something to do with things like that Russian airliner that came down from Egypt a little while ago.
Oh, okay.
Could be something there. So something's been picked up in intelligence circles, and they're pretty worried about it. So
is it primarily America that's enforcing this, or is it the airlines, or who?
It's the United States first, and then the UK followed, but it didn't have as wide a range of countries.
Right. Okay. Watch this space.
Yeah, watch it, and I think anyone that's travelling needs to be just very cognizant of where they're going through. I think if you're just in transit, it's fine, but if you were staying 24 hours or 2 days somewhere on the way,
yeah,
you know, if somewhere like Turkey is a worry, then, you know, people that might be going for Gallipoli remembrance and then going on, that might be an issue for them. But it depends where they're going. At the moment, it's only the UK and the United States.
Interesting. All right, mate. Well, thanks for the chat.
Thank you.
Good to have you on board again. Have you got a book review?
All right. Yeah, this week's book is a bit the same but a little bit different. It's actually The History of Photography by Beaumont Newhall. And Beaumont Newhall was one of the first directors of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And this particular book was originally written in 1937. And he added various editions until 1982.
Wow.
So it's a historic book about the history of photography. And it's got a lot of photographs from the Museum of Modern Art, and a lot of it is probably in more detail of early photography up to the 30s, and then subsequent photography has been added with just some nominal things about colour towards the end. And the book is actually plenty of words and plenty of pictures, but written in a very, very relaxed style. And it sort of covers about people searching for capturing the image to the invention of photography, and then starting to work through daguerreotypes, calotypes, and that sort of thing all the way through. It's a fairly hefty book, but it's an older history of photography and has a different view to some of the modern books. So it probably weighs in at about a kilo, but not quite big enough to be able to use to get the peanut butter off the top shelf.
Right. It would be amazing to see the various releases of that book, because, you know, the way photography changed over that 50-year period alone would just be epic.
Well, that's right. And as I said, that's what makes this a bit of a different book, because the early parts are clearly written before a lot of things have come in. And
before colour, I would imagine.
Yes. There are a few things right at the end about colour, but not a lot.
Right.
So it hasn't got a lot, although the first colour photo recorded here was 1904. And there's actually a 1907 photograph of Alfred Stieglitz.
Was that really photographed in colour, or was it just painted afterwards?
Well, you've got to remember the first actual colour photograph was done by James Clerk Maxwell in the 1870s, where he used three different filters.
Oh, that's right, yes.
And it was a fairly crude photograph, but yeah, there were beginnings of that, and they were using autochrome to start with. They actually used dyed potato starch as part of it.
Wow.
So it appears to me that there is a very limited number. There's only four or five colour photographs in here, and they basically cover autochrome and then Kodachrome.
Oh, wow.
The rest of the book is about techniques, approaches, and compositional styles and things like that. So it's actually quite an interesting but different review of photography.
Yeah.
The History of Photography by Beaumont Newhall. It's published by the Museum of Modern Art in New York, and Booko has it from $47 right through to $69, and it's a large paperback. It's not a hardback.
Right.
It's interesting that the current edition is the 1984 edition. Right. So it hasn't been renewed since, but it's still in print.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for that. And thank you for keeping the chair warm for Glenn.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
No worries, mate. All right. We'll talk with you again next week.
ShutterZincPodcast.com.
AnotherAudioTo.com quality podcast.
For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@ShutterZincPodcast.com.